We are looking together at 1 Peter chapter 3. And we've come to verse 13. Now, in this section that we've been looking at, Peter has been preparing his Christian readers to face persecution. They must expect persecution. That is normal for the Christian in this world. They will suffer evil and insult from the people of this world. Peter makes that plain in verse 9. But, says Peter, when Christians are persecuted for Christ, they must not try to take revenge. Verse 9, do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. You must not hate those who try to harm you. No, says Peter, rather you bless them. Do not repay evil with evil, insult with insult, but with blessing. You pray for those who hate you. You call down blessings on their heads. And that is the calling of the Christian. To this, says Peter, you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. As we live in this way, we show that we are true children of God. And we look forward to inheriting all the blessings that God has prepared for his children. Now, between verses 10 and 12, Peter gives an example of a man of God from Old Testament times. A man who lived in this way. He quotes for us a psalm written by David at a great crisis in his life. It was written at a time when David was being persecuted in the most horrible way, simply because he was a man of God. David was driven from his home. He was driven into the desert. He was separated from his friends and his family. He was humiliated. He was in great physical danger. He was being hunted down like a wild animal. And yet, in that situation, David sang a psalm. The words we have here in verses 10 to 12 are part of that psalm, that song of joy, which David wrote on that day when this persecution was at its height. We read the whole psalm last week, but I think it's worth just reading it again this morning. It's Psalm 34. I'm very conscious of the fact that there are folk here this morning who weren't here last week. And if we're going to grasp what Peter is saying to us, we need to understand the passage. He quotes Psalm 34. Here is David in the desert, a refugee, a fugitive, being hunted by his enemies. And David says this, I will extol the Lord at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. My soul will boast in the Lord. Let the afflicted hear and rejoice. Glorify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame. This poor man called, And the Lord heard him. He saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him lack nothing. The lions may grow weak and hungry, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. What a tremendous statement of the Christian's confidence. Here is David in that situation of terrible hurt. He's been attacked, he's been betrayed, he's been humiliated and degraded. He's been stripped of everything that people think is valuable. And David is singing. He's singing a song of pure joy. I will extol the Lord. His praise will always be on my lips. My soul will boast of the Lord. Let's exalt his name together. Here is a man who is rejoicing in God. Men can rob him of his comfort. Men can steal his possessions. Men can take away his good name and slander him. They may remove him from his family and his friends and leave him utterly alone, but they cannot take his God away from him. Taste and see that the Lord is good, he says. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. This man is tasting God. This man is enjoying God. He's experiencing God's love. He's delighting in God's friendship. And so he says, he lacks no good thing. What an extraordinary thing to say. He's a ragged, exhausted man hiding out in a cave in the desert, not knowing where his next meal is going to come from, being hunted by his enemies. And he says, I'm not lacking anything. I'm not lacking anything I need, because the only thing I need in the end is God himself. And I have God. For David to have the friendship, the love of God, is more important than anything else in the world. It is the only thing that matters in the end. And that is why David is so determined not to do anything that would spoil his fellowship with God. Verse 11 of the psalm, come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking lies. Turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. For David, real life means walking with God. Knowing God. Good days, the phrase he uses there in verse 12. Good days mean days when he is tasting the goodness of God. And that's why David keeps his tongue from evil. Other people may slander him and hurt him, but he'll never repay their insults with insult. Other people may try to do him evil, but he turns from evil to do good to his enemies. They may seek to harm him, but he will always show love to them. Why? Because that's the way to walk with God. That is the way to enjoy God's friendship. And for David, knowing God is more important than possessions. It's more important than comfort. It's more important than his reputation. It's more important than physical health. It's more important in the end than life itself. A man or woman who knows God may lose his life in this world, but he'll live forever. He'll live for all eternity. For endless years he'll be tasting and discovering and delighting in the goodness of God. There is no peace, no joy, no thrill like walking in God's will. And that's David's great discovery. That's David's testimony from that cave in the desert. And that then is what lies behind Peter's words. Back in 1 Peter chapter 3. Peter has quoted that psalm. He's shown us a man who can delight in God and who lacks no good thing despite all that he's suffering. And then Peter can ask this question in verse 13. Who is going to harm you if you are eager to do good? Now it would be easy to misunderstand Peter's question here in verse 13. Peter is not saying, surely nobody will try to harm you if you are eager for good. No, all the way through, Peter has been saying the very opposite to that. He's been telling the people will try to harm them, even if they do good. No, the question Peter is asking is this: who can harm you if you are eager for good? Who can harm a man like David, whose great passion, whose only passion, is to know God and do God's will? At the end of this verse, we have the believer described as a man who's eager to do good. But that's not exactly what Peter writes. What Peter writes is simply that the believer is a man who is eager for good. That is to say, he is a man who is eager to know the goodness of God and to respond to it by a life of goodness. Now Peter asks, if we are believers, if we are men like David, whose great passion is to know God, whose great passion is to enjoy God and to imitate God and to walk with God, who can harm us? All David cared about was to taste God's goodness and therefore to please him and to turn from evil to do what was good. Now, says Peter, who can harm a man like that? You can take away his home, but he's still got the one thing that's really important to him. He's still able to taste the goodness of God. You can take away his friends, but he's still got the friendship of God. You can lock him in a prison cell, but he's still got the company of God. You can break his body, and you can torture his mind, but you can't touch his soul, which is rejoicing in God. You can't harm that man in the end, because you can't take away from him the one thing he really cares about. You can't take his God away from him. You can't stop him from enjoying God. Look at David again. Battered physically, bruised emotionally, half-starved, dressed in rags, no friends. And he's singing, I will extol the Lord at all times. My soul will boast in him. Those who seek the Lord lack nothing that's really good. Who can harm a man like that? The harder you hit him, the louder he sings. The more wrong people do to him, the more determined he is to respond by doing good to them. The more pain you cause him, the happier he is at the thought that he's drawing near to God. Now, do you see what Peter is saying to these Christian people? They can see persecution coming. They can see real suffering on the horizon, and it is frightening. But Peter is saying to them, look, you have nothing to fear. Who can harm you? They can't take your God away from you. They can't take away your prospect of everlasting joy. They can't take away the blessing which you are to inherit as God's children. They can't take away from you anything that really matters. I suppose nobody outside the pages of the Bible has put this more wonderfully than Martin Luther did in the hymn we've just sung. And let the prince of ill look grim as e'er he will, he harms us not a whit. You see, says Luther, nobody, not even Satan himself, nothing can harm us. Why? For though they take our life, goods, honour, children, wife, yet is their profit small. These things shall vanish all. The city of God remaineth. Do you see what Luther's saying? The things they take away from you are things you are going to lose anyway. Your possessions, your friends, even your family, they're not going to last. We all go naked out of this world. None of us can take these things with us. Our health and strength, we all grow old and weak and frail and senile if our lives are not cut off before old age. Our life itself, what a fragile, short thing it is. You see, all the things that men can take from us are things which are going to pass away in any case. But they can't take from us our eternal possessions. They can't take from us our place in the city of God. They can't take from us the prospect of sitting as God's heirs with Christ on the throne of heaven. They can't take away from us the prospect of looking into the face of God and seeing him smile upon us for all eternity. They can't take away from us anything that really matters. Nothing, says Luther. Nothing, says David. Nothing, says Peter, can really harm you if your great desire is for God himself and if your great longing is to do what pleases him, regardless of what others do to you. The only thing a Christian has to be frightened of is his own sin. You know, if somebody else tells lies about you, they can't really damage you. They can make you sound a worthless, horrible sinner, but then you are that. That's only the truth. They can't actually damage you. But if you respond to their slanders by becoming bitter and full of hatred, then you're damaged. Because your fellowship with God is broken and your own soul is hurt. But while you are determined to do good, while you are determined to respond with love to those who try to hurt you, then nothing can really harm you, says Peter. In this one verse, just these few words, Peter surely is summing up Paul's superb declaration, which we know so well from Romans 8. If God is for us, who can be against us? Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble, or hardship, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or danger, or sword? As it's written, for your sake we do face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. We are more than conquerors, says Paul. The conqueror on the battlefield is the one who survives. But we don't just survive as all these things press upon us. These things actually add to our everlasting happiness. These things actually prepare us for glory. God uses these things to make us ready for everlasting joys. We aren't just conquerors. We are more than conquerors. We are people who come away from the battle, from the hurt, enriched eternally. That's Paul's perspective. And that's Peter's perspective too, here in this passage. Who can harm you, he says, if your heart is set on the goodness of God, and if that is your great passion? Who can harm you? Nobody, is his implication. Nobody, nothing can harm you. Verse 14, even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. You see, it's the contrary. Far from harming you, suffering brings blessing to you. You must expect suffering, but you still have God's blessing in this world and in the world to come. What is this blessing? Well, we've seen the terms of it back in verse 12. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. His ears are attentive to their prayer. You may suffer, says Peter, for what is right, but every moment you will have the eyes of your God watching over you. You will have the ears of your God listening to your cries. You will have the undivided loving attention of the God who controls a billion, billion, billion galaxies. He will give you all his attention as if you were the only creature in the universe. You will have his blessing, says Peter. You'll hear his voice whispering to you through the pain. My child, I love you. I'm here. I'm touched with the feelings of your suffering. I will never leave you nor forsake you. It doesn't mean that the suffering isn't real, but it does mean that in it all, through it all, at the end of it all, you have God. And if you have God, nothing else matters. So Peter can sum up the application at the end of verse 14. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. The people of this world are afraid of so many things. They're afraid of pain. They're afraid of loneliness. They're afraid of losing their jobs. They're afraid of being left out of things. They're afraid of being laughed at. They're afraid of illness. They're afraid of death. Peter says quite simply, do not be afraid of any of those things. Do not be frightened, he says. Because if all those things happen, they will still not harm you, because you will still have God. I've said so many times before to you that fear is a crippling thing. To live in constant anxiety, with a knot in your stomach, terrified of things that might conceivably happen in the future, it's misery to live like that. And it makes you fit for nothing. Fear cripples you. But Peter's answer to your fears is not to say to you as Christians, well, don't worry. The things you're frightened about certainly won't happen. No, says Peter, all those things may happen. But it makes no difference. Because if they do happen, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. That's the answer to fear. All these things may happen, but I'm still blessed because I still have my God. I believe that sometimes when we're afraid, it's worth asking ourselves, what is the worst scenario? a Christian comes to me. He's a true believer. He's a man who loves God. He's a man who's holding on to Jesus Christ day by day and seeking to honor him in the place where he works. But this man is going through a very hard time, perhaps in his work. And he's so worried. He's so tense. He's living with fear all the time. He's got a knot in his stomach. He comes to me and he says, "You know, I'm so worried. I'm so frightened. The boss has really got it in for me. You see, I won't agree to put the company in front of my family and in front of the church and in front of my God. And so the boss has really got it in for me. I can see his hostility every time I go into work. And it's making me feel ill. I'm so worried." Well, I ask that man, "Can you explain to me exactly what you're frightened about? What's the worst that can happen?" "Well, I suppose he could sack me." "Oh, I see. And then, what's the worst that can happen?" "Well, at my age, I might never get another job. Especially when people know I was sacked." "Oh, I see. And then, what's the worst that can happen?" "Well, I might lose my home. I won't be able to pay the mortgage." "Oh, I see. And then, what's the worst that can happen?" "Well, I might finish up living in the gutter, in a cardboard box." "And then? Come on, I want the worst scenario. What's the worst that can happen?" "Well, if I'm homeless, I may not even be able to get any benefits." "And so, come on, what's the worst that can happen?" "Well, I could starve or freeze to death there in the gutter." "Yes, and then tell me the worst that can happen." "Well, then I suppose I'll be in heaven." "And then what's the worst that can happen?" "Well, then I suppose the worst that can happen is that I'll be infinitely, endlessly happy, and I'll enjoy God forever." Do you see, when you've reckoned up the very worst that can happen, the Christian is still going to be infinitely, completely happy forever. The very worst that you can happen, if all the things that you're afraid of happen, the very worst that can happen is that you have a few minutes, a few hours, a few months, a few years of pain or loneliness before you enter into the endless joys of heaven. The pains of this world will leave no scars. One moment of looking into the face of the Saviour, one moment of tasting his love in that world, will obliterate the memory of the pain as if it never happened. It'll be like a dream in the night when you've woken up into the full blaze of day. And it will not be one moment of enjoying Christ, or 1 year, or 1 billion years. We have all eternity to walk with Jesus Christ, discovering more of his love every moment, and knowing that the end is no nearer than when we began. Knowing that it's never going to end. Knowing that our fellowship with him is going to go on and on, and there's never any shadow of parting at the end. When we've been there 10,000 years, 10 billion years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing his praise than when we first begun. And that's why Peter can say, "Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. You're facing illness and you're frightened. Well, what's the worst that can happen? If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, If you're a repentant sinner clinging to the Saviour, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is that your illness will bring you into the Father's house more quickly than you could otherwise have got there. You're facing loneliness. What's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is that your loneliness gives you more time and opportunity to build your friendship with God here in this world than you would otherwise have had. And then you will step into the world where you will have His friendship forever. Whatever it is that causes that fear within you, Peter says, do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. If you are a child of God, you have ahead of you life, eternal life, the fellowship, the love, the intimacy of God forever. And this is not just pious theory concocted by some mystical monk cut off from the world in a monastery. David says, those who seek the Lord shall lack no good thing. And David is a half-starved fugitive whose enemies are trying to kill him. Martin Luther says, nothing can harm me, not even if they take my life, goods, honour, children, wife. And Martin Luther, as he writes those words, is a man in constant danger, harried from one place to another, knowing that if he ever falls into the hands of his enemies, he'll be burned alive. Paul says, we are more than conquerors. Nothing can separate us from the love of God. And he's a man who's been lashed almost to death. Dead. He's been shipwrecked 3 times. He spent a day and a night in the open sea clinging to wreckage. He's been attacked by bandits. He's labored and toiled and gone without sleep. He's known hunger and thirst. He's often gone without food. He's been cold and naked. And he's still saying, nothing shall separate us from the love of Christ. Peter says, who can harm us? And he's been in and out of prison. He's constantly being harassed by the authorities. He knows he's going to finish his life being torn to pieces by wild beasts in the arena. And all these men, David and Luther and Paul and Peter, join their testimony. And they say to you and to me, do not be afraid. If we have God, nothing can harm us. We have not been harmed by all we've gone through. It's brought us nearer to God. Even in this world, they tell us to have the friendship of God outweighs 1,000 times all we've been through. And to have the prospect of eternal joy makes our suffering seem trivial by comparison. That is the united testimony of these men from across the centuries. And millions upon millions of ordinary men and women down through the centuries who have loved Christ and suffered for him join with these great names. Men and women who have been tortured on the rack, who have been frozen in the Siberian snows, who have wept in lonely dungeons, who have burned at the stake, who have been abandoned by family and friends, they join together and they say, do not be afraid of what men may do to you. And they are entitled to say it. They say, when you pass through the deep waters, he will be with you. He was with us. These people tell us, these people testify to us that in their dungeons and even on the rack, they have tasted the goodness of God. And they say, do not be afraid. And if we could catch one glimpse of the joys that those men and women are experiencing now in the presence of God, then we would fear nothing. If we could catch one glimpse of the unmixed joy of holy spirits around the throne, then all our fears would vanish away. And we would say, if 10 deaths lay between us and Christ, we still must be there. Let's hear one last testimony. Do not fear, says Peter. Do not fear what others fear. Don't be frightened. Once again, Peter is quoting. Who wrote those words originally? They were written by Isaiah. And they were written at a time of crisis. Isaiah is living in the city of Jerusalem. And God warns Isaiah that Jerusalem is going to be attacked by a most savage and ruthless enemy. The Lord is about to bring against them the mighty flood waters of the river. The king of Assyria, with all his pomp, it will overflow all its channels, run over all its banks. Raise the war cry, you nations, and be shattered. Listen, all you distant lands, prepare for battle and be shattered. The Assyrians are on the horizon, approaching Jerusalem, and they are the most savage, the most sadistic and brutal soldiers that the world has ever known. And they're going to be coming up against Jerusalem, Isaiah's home. They're going to come as a vast army, like a river breaking its banks. I'm sure that thoughts of terror must have gripped Isaiah's mind. He can picture in his mind the massacres, the mutilations, the gang rapes, the tortures that he and his family and his friends may be subjected to. And then he says, "The Lord spoke to me with his strong hand upon me. And he said, do not call conspiracy everything that these people call conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear, and do not dread it. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread, and he will be a sanctuary. Whatever comes to you, Isaiah, you will have a sanctuary, because you will have me. I will be your hiding place. Your soul is safe in me. No one and nothing can harm you, Isaiah. You are safe for eternity." And Isaiah hears those words from the Lord, and Isaiah bows his head and he says, "I will wait for the Lord. He may be hiding his face from the house of Jacob, but I will put my trust in him." Some of you see so many threatening and frightening things on your horizon. Illness, sorrow, unemployment, humiliation, loneliness. If I were to say to you, do not fear, do not be frightened, you might dismiss it. You would be entitled to dismiss it and to say, what right has he got to talk? What right has he got to tell me not to be frightened? He's never been where I've been. But it's not me that says those words to you. It's David from that cave in the desert. It's Paul from the prison cell in Rome. It's Peter as he walks the way to the arena where he's going to be torn to pieces. It's Isaiah as he sees the Assyrians and all the horror of war coming towards him. It's these men who say to you, do not fear, do not be afraid. And it's Jesus. It's Jesus, the author and finisher of your faith. The one who began the road of faith and the one who completes it. It's Jesus who, for the joy before him, endured the cross, despising the shame. It's Jesus, the one who suffered as no man has ever suffered. It's Jesus, the one who was broken on a cross. It's Jesus, the one whose body was smashed and whose mind was torn apart by grief. It's Jesus who says to you, "Fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze, for I am the Lord your God." If we have this Christ, and if he is our God, what have we to fear in this world or in all eternity? May God speak to each of our hearts from his own holy word. Especially may God speak to those of you who do not yet have Christ. And may God make himself known to your hearts and take away your fears. Amen.